This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will usually, most episodes, select with some degree of randomness. Just not this episode. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 36th episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, I'm looking at Constantine number 8 from the DC Comics New 52, cover dated January 2012. But first, a whole lot of feedback. Jason Trenner and Luke Giaconetti, both faithful emailers, each reported being a little behind in the episodes with busy summers and family and all that. So each of them sent long emails hitting multiple topics and episodes. So I'm going to sprinkle in those emails as I cover each past episode. So their names will come up a lot in this segment. On episode 31, the Doctor Strange episode, Jason said, "That was fun. I know the co-writer for the Fear Lords backup. Not extremely well, but we were in the same Yahoo group, and I've seen him post on various places. The Fear Lord stories I really need to get, as it sounded like a fun romp." I really agree with that, Jason. The main story of that issue was okay, but definitely the backup is what made that issue a really fun read, and same for the issue before, where the Fear Lord story began. Luke said that he was always tempted by Doctor Strange comics when he sees them in the cheap bins, because the Doc is an interesting character whom creators can take in a wide range of stories. This particular story did have that part feel of Six to it, but at least it had some action and it seemed to move along briskly. Plus, the backup story sounds real cool, again with the backup stories adding a lot of entertainment to this issue. Luke also gives me some Quarter Bin advice. An Infinity Gauntlet tie-in is not so much of a problem, but the Infinity Crusade tie-ins are the one you have to watch out for. That I will keep in mind. In episode 32, we covered an issue of Shadow of the Bat, and Luke wrote in, "I always liked bad guys with ironic last names, like we get with Payne in this issue. This type of naming is still used in modern day, as Tom DeFalco introduced a character named, wait for it, Dr. Payne, in the closing issues of The Savage Hawkman. And wonder of wonders, the guy turns out to be an evil scientist experimenting on his patients. If only there had been some sign to warn us." Of course, the greatest one of these bad guys to me is Gideon Mace, a mercenary who had his right hand replaced with, wait, Luke, let me guess, a sword? No, wait, a gun. A really big gun. A titanium mace. Oh, I should have guessed that. A titanium mace, which, by the way, can also spray chemical mace. So this was a guy really living into his gimmick, okay? I'm in the same boat as you, Professor, when it comes to patriotism. I do wonder if Alan Grant made Payne purposefully over the top and ridiculous, like maybe a satire. Sharing the blame between the government and Payne might suggest that Grant may have been implying that the government serves merely to embolden the thing which divides us instead of the things we share. Am I giving him way too much credit? Yes, Luke, I think that's giving him way too much credit. He concludes with, "As a side note, I have to say that wanting to be, quote, the happiest kid in Gotham, unquote, is a pretty small hurdle, considering the incredible amount of misery in that town." That's a good point, Luke. That does seem to be a really low standard. Neil Stanifer wrote a message titled, "Angry Alan Grant is Angry." First thing, when I saw this email subject, I saw it on my iTouch. It doesn't show that many words, so all I saw for the subject heading line was Angry Alan, and thought, wow, I must have come across really mad. Oh, but now I know it was Alan Grant, not Professor Alan. That was a relief. Neil said that he missed the Shadow of the Bad issues when they came out. I wished I'd caught them, so that I could have read along, but your synopses are awesome. Alan Grant's portrayal of the ugly American was incomplete without a muscular blue-eyed Jesus, as you pointed out, Fabio with roid rage. Still, I suppose it's fair play. After all, the religious right wasn't quite the big deal at the time that it is now, and many UK folks don't know what a big role religion plays in American politics. Besides, I still can't stand haggis, and I would never toss away a perfectly usable caber, so fair is fair. But yeah, that was a two-dimensional antagonist, a stalking horse for a Scotsman's view of the CIA. And don't I love being enlightened by a Scotsman on the shortcomings of the American political landscape? Boy, howdy. Those are good points, Neil. I obviously don't have a problem with a person commenting on the government or politics or society of another system. I have strong feelings about the state of the EU, for example. But I try to be accurate, and as you were hinting at, to not engage in stereotypes to make my point. So for now, let me just pull the corncob pipe out of my mouth, hop on the John Deere, and check the crops. Because I'm from the American Midwest. Jason Trenner compared the ugly American to Nuke from Marvel, the original Frank Miller take and not the cyborg version, he points out. And it was weird not to see Batman having plans that would probably make the government agents the laughingstocks and utterly embarrassed. Like I said on that episode, Jason, the fallible Batman was that story's main strong point. On episode 33, we revisited my space-age buddy Adam Strange, and Podcasting's Michael Bradley thanked me for devoting another episode to that character. I've talked to you before about my love for this character, yet this particular issue is one that I haven't read. The only one of these tributes I picked up at the time was the Superman issue, though I've since found the GL one. It sounds as if I'll have to add the Adam Strange issue to the want list. Quarter bin or not? Elliot S. Magan, J.H. Williams, Grant Morrison, Jerry Ordway, and Alex Ross in one Adam Strange comic? Yes, please. Shut up and take my money. Great episode as always. Well, thank you, M. Brads. It's nice to have people I like and respect liking the show. Unfortunately, it does speak to Adam Strange's popularity, or lack thereof, that his is the only one of these eight tribute books that I've ever seen in cheap bins. And I agree, the Green Lantern one really does intrigue me as well. By the way, I just recently talked some Adam Strange with Sean Engel on episode 133 of the excellent Just One of the Guys podcast. Between that and the four issues I've covered him here on the Quarterbin, my appreciation for Adam Strange and what makes him unique in comics has really been rekindled in the last year or so. There will definitely be more talk of the Stranges on the network sometime, somehow, whether on this specific podcast or some other way. The Metropolis Kid, Kyle Benning, emailed in, maybe for the first time. More Adam Strange. I love this book. Little Russell Burbage hooked me up with a copy a few months back. I didn't realize there were others in the series, and I don't recall ever seeing any of these when they came out. I love the Elliot S. Magan tale from the book. It was really a classic throwback to the era in terms of how it felt. On to the Morrison story. Well, I love the Jerry Ordway art, and while I appreciate what Morrison was trying to do here, instead of a story acting as a meta-tribute to Schwartz, maybe he could have just written a prose piece that ran inside the front and back cover, like they did with the Robert Greenberger essays and all the DC Millennium reprints a few years before. Then we could have had a second story more reflective of the era, maybe Kerry Bates or Ordway himself. But still, a great book and a nice tribute to Julia Schwartz. Thanks so much for the feedback, Kyle, and for listening. I had never heard of any of these books until grabbing this one, and it was a fun surprise. I can't imagine an editor trying to rein in Grant Morrison. That has got to be the hardest part of the job of editing. Standing alone, the Morrison story wouldn't have worked for me, but together in context, having two so different stories really did. Thanks again, Kyle. Jason Trenner remembered these tribute one-shots. I got the Justice League one and the Hawkman one. They were fun, as was the Adam Strange issue. Luke Giaconetti opened his commentary with a question. So when are you going to break down and start your Adam Strange podcast? To which I replied, you mean when are we going to break down and start our Adam Strange Hawkman podcast? Which is no dumber than teaming up, I don't know, Aquaman and Firestorm, for crying out loud. He said that the Magan story sounded like a lot of fun, with some added pathos for good measure. Normally, we'd think the couple pair up for Adam and Alana would be Katar and Shayera Hall, but pairing them with Ralph and Sue is such a great twist. Absolutely, Luke. To me, that's really what made the story. On to the Grant Morrison tale, Luke said that it's pretty much what he would have expected, talking about the concept of Space Age, Silver Age as meta-commentary. I'd love to read it, honestly, because I think what Morrison is getting at really does sound thought-provoking. I need to find this issue for sure. By the way, Professor, the Hawkman one of these is a lot of fun as well, as it features flying gorillas drawn by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Did he just say flying gorillas? Oh, that's right, it's DC. Now it makes sense. Let's move on to episode 34, the Marvel 2-in-1 issue featuring The Thing and Moon Knight. Jason Trenor said that Crossfire is someone he knew mostly from being a Hawkeye foe. As for the mind control angle and such, well, no one ever said Crossfire was the sanest or most strategic supervillain. It was interesting to see this was the first comic for the big two for the writer, and that writer is still writing comics to this day. Yeah, I thought that was interesting too, Jason. That was Stephen Grant, by the way, who wrote that issue. He also says that he won't laugh at me for liking Moon Knight. I mean, seriously, you know the list of oddballs and offbeat characters that I like? That is true. Having chatted with Fanboyamus Prime more than once, that would be a pot calling the kettle black situation. Luke reported that he bought this issue out of a 33-cent bin. Now, by the way, listeners, 3 for $1 does count as honorary quarter bin books. Just don't tell Shag. He's kind of fragile about stuff like that. Luke adds, Marvel 2-in-1 is pretty much my favorite book to find in cheap bins because, well, the ever-loving blue-eyed thing plus another member of the Marvel Universe, what's not to like? I dig this title even more than Marvel Team-Up, although that's a good cheap book to pick up too. I gave this issue to my friend Doug, a huge modern Moon Knight fan, and of course, he appreciated a random issue of MTIO. And you have to love any comic with Frenchie in it. So between me and this guy Doug, Luke knows every Moon Knight fan in the world. Okay. And yes, team-up books are perfect sources for one-off stories from the cheap bins. Kyle Benning reports on Facebook that he loves this series. And you can't beat only paying a quarter for an issue. That has become the rallying cry for this podcast. 25 cents makes it really hard to be angry or even disappointed with a read. Kyle sort of agreed, that's true. But some issues still do come to mind that are barely worth 25 cents, but they're few and far between. Rob Kelly of the Fire and Water podcast and the Aquaman Shrine website also commented about that issue and that title. Marvel 2-in-1 is the perfect quarter bin book, never promising more than solid entertainment. It almost always delivered just that. It was not a book that I bought regularly, but growing up, if I had a little extra scratch at the newsstands, it was a book I turned to often. I agree. I think you guys are really right on target with this. I definitely need to be on the lookout for team-up books for this show. Because they're books I didn't read very much, I sort of glaze over them when I go through the cheap stacks, but they really do fit this format really well. Rob continues, I wish comic fans were interested in series like this nowadays, but it doesn't seem like they are. Great choice for an episode for the show. Yeah, you know, in this trade paperback era, a book that's a series of one-off adventures just doesn't fit a publisher's business model, I think. And Rob ends by saying that he wants that FF, it's clobberin' time, as his ringtone. Now, of course, I do nothing original. I liberated that clip from the excellent Fantasticast promo. Well, thank you all for the feedback. Keep it coming. We've got a promo to play here. The excellent Fantasticast promo, as a matter of fact. And then, I know, finally, we'll get to New 52 Constantine Issue 8.
The dawn of an age. The founding of a family.
You know we haven't done enough research into the effects of cosmic rays.
We've got to take that chance.
Conditions are right tonight. Let's go.
They're penetrating the ship. Our shielding isn't strong enough.
I feel like I'm burning up.
Too heavy. Can't move.
Too heavy.
We're all alive.
I feel so strange.
You're fading away. I can't see you at all anymore.
Look what's happened to you. You're changing.
Oh, Reed, not you too.
What happened to me? To all of us?
I can fly.
We gotta use that power to help mankind, right?
And so was born the Fantastic Four.
For soon the Mole-Man will have the entire world in his power.
I am the mightiest living mortal on Earth. And now, mankind shall feel that might.
The Fantastic Four. Little do they dream, they're but pawns in the hands of Dr. Doom.
The Human Torch will be the Puppet Master's next victim.
You Earthlings can't change the way I can. That means I'm the most powerful person on Earth.
I've been expecting you, for I am the Thinker.
I vow never to return, my lord, until the Fantastic Four are no more and the planet Earth is no more.
You're in the presence of the awesome Ramatons, King of Kings, Master of Men, and Lord of the Seven Suns.
Fool, you're just a muscular freak. Blind or Hulk.
Stop! You must not end on the Castle of Diablo.
My journey has ended. This planet shall sustain me until it has been drained of all elemental life. So speak, Galactus.
Flame on!
It's clobbering time!
The Fantastic Four from the very beginning. Witness the origins of a legend. The Fantasticast. ffcast.libsyn.com.
And we're back. Constantine number 8 had a cover price of $2.99, meaning I acquired this comic at a tremendous 91% discount. Less than a year passed between this book coming out and this book being plucked from a quarter box at Half Price Books. I mean, they do have $1 comics there, but this one went straight to the cheapest of the cheap bins. The cover, by Eddie Barrows, Eber Ferreira, and Brad Anderson, shows the villainous Sargon the Sorceress with a wicked smile, holding what appears to be a human heart in her hand, proffering it to us, the readers. John Constantine is in the background, and he appears to be hanging on a wall in a vaguely cruciform position. But that probably doesn't signify anything. The story, Spot the Hustle, was written by Ray Fox with art by Aiko. The issue itself starts with a chess match, already in progress, between John Constantine and the mysterious Mr. E. But like most fictional chess matches, this one is a metaphor for the actual battle going on between the two. But John gives us the title of the story right here, reminding us that his chess tutor used to tell him in every match to be careful and spot the hustle. John knows that he has been set up, I guess, in the last issue, but he doesn't know by who, and more important, he doesn't know why. We are currently in the Swiss Alps, and we are not actually playing chess. Here in the Temple of the Cold Flame, I'm 10 steps out of Sargon's bed before our eyeless friend Mr. E shows me some of his American Southern courtesy by hitting me in the back. Mr. E is impressed with Constantine's ability to leap out of his body like that. The more I deal with you, the more I respect you. But John doesn't want to talk, he wants to fight. And so they fight. From what I can piece together, the fight has something to do with the control of magic? Maybe? There's a lot of green, swirly, mystical energies on the page, as well as some good old-fashioned consequences being exchanged. They throw each other off the edge of a really high cliff at one point, but both magically poof back to the room where they were before. Then Constantine is able to snag a weapon from near Sargon's bed in the Temple of the Cold Flame, and that may make all the difference. The Law of the Cold Flame denies any member the right to hurt another, but it doesn't state that they can't help someone hurt another by, like, leaving a super-duper powerful weapon nearby. The moon blade I hold is a unique weapon. It changes shape with the phases of the moon. A long sword when it's full, a dagger when it's new. The weapon can also hold persons and concepts within it, like thoughts, dreams, energies, and it can kill just about anything. Constantine takes a mighty swing at Mr. E, and in a two-page splash with lots of white and blue magic energies, he drives the moonblade right through his chest. And as the man's heart stops, his energies are sucked up by Sargon, the bloody would-be goddess of a new age, and her companion Tanarak, the greatest mystical genius of his time. Which means that maybe they were planning for this, waiting for whichever one of them would die to die, so they could carve him up like a bloody pie. "Ah, John," Sargon says, "you're a sweet man. As infuriating as you can be, you do know how to make a girl happy." Constantine announces that he is keeping the Moonblade, and then Sargon has somehow talked him into joining her as a cold flamer. "Can't you see that we're unstoppable? Join us, and we could make a lover's playground of this world and every other." A couple of hours later, once he's sworn their oaths and bowed at their feet and swallowed their drugged wine, once they're all smiles, John does something unexpected. There alone with the Moonblade, we find out that when Constantine stabbed Mr. E, he also bound Mr. E's soul to the weapon. The spell that did that is evidently a secret, something that John alone could have done. So his new friends in the Cold Flame cult don't know that the man is in the sword. As far as Tanarak and Sargon are concerned, Mr. E is dead, dead, dead. Because, as John explains it, the Cold Flame set up Mr. E. They left the sword for Constantine to find. Right now they're laughing, fizzing with the power they took from your corpse. So what are you going to do about it? From inside the sword, Mr. E offers Constantine unlimited power and the chance for revenge if he sets him loose from the sword to battle the Cold Flamers, blah, blah, blah. But even though he's more than a little bit tipsy, Constantine does not fall for this. "Nice try. No, this is what you're going to do. Tell me everything about the Cold Flame. Everything. That? Right, throw this sword into a dimensional portal, and you get to spend 5,000 years in silence and shadow." Because Constantine's plan is to learn the weaknesses of the cult, and then the two of them, Constantine and the sword-bound Mr. E, can kill both Tanarak and Sargon. And to show that he's a good sport, and that he understands Mr. E's need for vengeance, John promises to let Mr. E choose which of the pair they will kill first. Then, as the issue closes up shop for the month, we get some references and a sort of scrying well to Shazam, that bloody child, and then a place full of bloody ignorant costume types, and then to Zatanna. These are teasers to Constantine's sort of newfound place in the regular DCU, even more than his appearances in Justice League Dark. And this story is to be continued retroactively, it says, however that works, in Trinity War. A DC crossover event. Oh, the joy.
Gathered together from the far reaches of the internet, I assembled a network of podcasts dedicated to the first and greatest superhero, Superman! The Superman Podcast Network is dedicated to covering all aspects of the Superman legend. Featuring
Superman and Batman.
Golden Age Superman.
The Superman Fan Podcast.
The DC Comics Presents Show.
From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
It's Superman.
The Schuster Herald Podcast.
The Kara's Herald Podcast.
Superman Forever Radio.
Superman Lives.
Up, Up, and Away.
Cadmus to Crisis, a Superboy podcast.
The Armored Hero Steel, a John Henry Allen podcast.
The world's best podcast.
Aye.
Radio KAL from supermanhomepage.com.
Joint hosts.
Michael Bradley.
John Wilson.
Billy Hogan.
Charlie Niemeyer.
Russell Bride.
Jeffrey Taylor.
Michael Bailey.
Scott Gardner.
Sam Rizzo.
Danny Sapp.
Bob Fisher.
Chris Moe.
Mario Benessi.
Drew Wintermeyer.
David Beyer.
Matthew M.
I'm Isaac.
I'm Adam.
Dave Eunice and co-host Scotty V.
At supermanpodcastnetwork.com. Veer, where's my spoo?
And we're back. Confession time. As I mentioned at the end of the last episode, this book being covered here in episode 36 is not the result of random selection. It was dictated by the calendar in two ways. One, it was being released in October, and other shows in the relatively geeky empire are doing horror-y Halloween-style books this month. So I looked through the Quarterbin database. There were a couple of vaguely horror-related options in there, including one that I've penciled in for next year. But when I saw this issue, I said to myself, Professor Allen, sir, isn't there a Constantine TV show coming up soon? And I answered myself, yes, sir, Professor, I think there is. We should look up when that show is debuting. I nodded to myself and thought, that's a great idea, Professor. Maybe we could do one of those back-to-the-bin-style bandwagon-jumping episodes. I stroked my goatee and answered, right, one of those shameless, obligatory pop culture tie-in episodes. Genius idea, Professor! Genius! As of the day this episode releases, the premiere of the Constantine TV show occurs in just 3 days, on October 24th, 2014, at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on NBC, who, unfortunately, is not sponsoring this episode. Confession time number two. This admission speaks directly to my status, or lack thereof, as a legitimate comic book dude. That is to say that just about everything I know about John Constantine comes from the four episodes of Hey Kids Comics, where Andrew and Michael Leyland covered issues of Hellblazer. Those episodes, by the way, are Season 1, Episode 8, and Season 2, Episodes 2, 4, and 19. No, I have never read a single issue of Hellblazer. But I guess it could be worse, at least I didn't see the Keanu Reeves movie. So I don't have that confusing my thoughts about the character. So that's gotta help, right? Actually, I do know a bit about this iteration of the character, though, having read the first 18 issues of Justice League Dark, and kind of liking them, and liking the John Constantine that was in those books. It's not the Vertigo version of that character, I understand that. But coming to the character in the New 52 as a blank slate, I kind of like him. And I really like what I've read of Justice League Dark, despite that comic having the worst name ever for a book. Anyway, on to discussing this issue itself. Obviously, this is the end of a storyline, beginning as we do in the middle of a fight, and by ending by rolling into a company-wide event. There are enough caption boxes to set the scene and bring me in, and as easy as it was to mildly make fun of the opening page, the chess match scene, that did actually set the scene as well, or maybe better, than the caption boxes on page 2 and 3 did. But this one did have the advantage of being the final issue of an arc. I would way rather read either the first or last of an arc as a single one-off than something in the middle. One of the drawbacks of that last Doctor Strange issue I covered, episode 31, by the way, was that it had the part 3 of 6 feeling to it. That was also an Infinity something or another crossover, so this reading experience could have been much worse if I'd picked up the next issue, part of Trinity War. It's also connected to the soon-coming Forever Evil event. By the way, check out the most recent episode of the New 52 Adventures of Superman if you're interested in a discussion of Trinity War, or episode 191 of Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box for a discussion of Forever Evil. I'm not opposed to big events or to big crossovers, but I almost always read those in trades. Individual issues is hard for reading long stories like that, at least for me, and certainly something like this podcast. It's always risky to pick up an issue not knowing where in the longer story an issue falls, especially with more books like this, newer books where almost every story is designed for the trade, that the risk of being dropped into the middle of something you don't understand is greatly increased than picking up a book from the 70s or 80s. But here in Constantine number 8, we're dropped into the end of something. And like I said, that helped make this a pleasant enough reading experience. And even though this did wrap up a story, the events took place in one location with a narrow focus, a small cast of characters. I like that. It gave the story a sense of intimacy somehow. There are big stakes here, huge stakes, I guess. The future of magic and all of that. But that big story is told with a really tightly focused manner. And that's a type of writing that tends to resonate with me. As a standalone issue, it would have been nice to know just a little bit more about the Temple of the Cold Flame. I remembered them as a big bad in the background of a Justice League Dark story, I think either the Zero issue or the first annual. But still, the drama that should have been there in Constantine joining the group at the end of the issue was lessened a bit for me. I think that was supposed to be a major shock, a major what is going on moment. We're supposed to think, how could he ever do that? But in the issue, those as bad guys weren't really explained all that well. So the drama that I think was supposed to be there in that moment was kind of lost on me. Like I said, I come to this iteration of Constantine with no preconceived notions from the Hellblazer days, so I'm not comparing him to his Vertigo version, and that's probably an advantage. Vertigo was a long-running, well-respected book, and it certainly benefits me to look at this issue in a vacuum without a book of such a high reputation hanging over me. One of the things I liked about the character of Constantine in Justice League Dark was his odd relationship, or at least his past, with Zatanna. It kind of makes sense. These are two powerful, magical characters. It's certain their paths would have crossed. They're not really a couple, per se, but somewhere deep down, evidently, I ship them, as the kids say. Because when Sargon plants a smoocheroo right on John after he agrees to join the Cold Flamers, I did think to myself, hey, buddy, what about Z? As far as the art, I don't know who Aiko is or what Aiko is. If it's one artist or a studio, I just don't know. This may be the first time I've run across Aiko's art, and it's pretty good. There's some creativity in panel design, lots of small panels inset inside larger panels, that sort of thing. So I don't know if that's part of Aiko's general style or just something that's being brought to this book. I also ought to mention Brad Anderson's colors, as those were effective in both enhancing the art and setting the mood for the different scenes. The verdict on Constantine 8? I've read better New 52 books. The New 52 was a jumping-on point for me, and I've read, mostly via trades, something like 200 issues worth of the New 52. And lots were better than this for my tastes. Wonder Woman, Demon Knights, All-Star Western, World's Finest, the previously mentioned Justice League Dark. But it told an interesting story, and told it pretty well. The Moonblade is a pretty cool weapon. The fight scenes were pretty to look at, and the technical details of the storytelling were fine. Certainly worth 25 cents. I am really curious how this particular book came to be in the quarter bins at Half Price Books. I have a theory, because there's no way anyone would place a one-year-old book in the 25-cent bin. Like I said, they have dollar bins at that store. It would make sense to price such a book at a buck, perhaps. Of course, New 52 and Marvel Now books will eventually end up in the cheapest of the cheap boxes. But I don't expect that for, I don't know, 5 years minimum? So here's what I think happened. On the day that I found this in the 25-cent bin, I also found an issue of Hellblazer, issue 211 to be precise, from 2005. I'm guessing that the person pricing these at the store assumed that they were together from the same run, from the same era, decided that the 9-year-old Hellblazer book deserved to be worth a quarter, and just assumed that Constantine number 8 also belonged in that same 25-cent box, which is where I plucked them out of. That wraps up my coverage of Constantine 8, bringing episode 36 of the Quarterbin podcast to a close. In episode 37, we'll be jumping back in time 35 years from this issue, back to one of the ongoing series we've been covering on the Quarterbin podcast, by looking at Micronauts number 8 from Marvel Comics, cover dated August 1979. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the podcast, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarterbin podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Shortbox Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.